Hello, everyone. This is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. Have any of you by any chance had the time to watch The Social Dilemma on Netflix? Of course, it's not breaking news that social networks are evil, but considering my very own online habits, it's depressing still, especially when kids come into play. If any of you have a killer idea how to get the explosive mix of kids and social media under control, please do write into me. But I don't want to be overly depressing today. There was a very special moment, though, in the film. A moment about the fact that we often don't understand why other people have such fundamentally different opinions and obviously do not realize that they are wrong. Of course, it's my opinion. Former employees of some of the most important social networks admit that the algorithms some of them help build force us into worldviews that are custom tailored to us. Well, that's not new to most of us, but still, we are being served the world we want to see, and we do not get to see all those other worlds out there. This means that someone who thinks and chooses right or left cannot but reject the other side. And this will help explain the ever-widening gap in our societies. Time for some countermeasurements today. Our guest is here to help break down some of our worldviews. And I can already say that he will do so. He is a huge fan of science fiction and space travel in general, and yet, at the same time, he questions human space activities. This is definitely going to be exciting. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you Dr. James Schwartz, space philosopher, author, self-described full-time space exploration and science fiction nerd, part-time musician, and amateur carpenter. So, James, what does a space philosopher do all day?
Well, it might vary from philosopher to philosopher. From an ethics angle, that plays an important role in thinking about space policy. When it comes to things like, potential regulation for the space mining industry, when it comes to thinking about, planning for off-world settlements where it's not just technology involved, but, human persons. More local things relating to how can we properly account for the environmental impact of space activities, launch sites and things of that nature. What are, guiding principles we can invoke to better protect the space environment, both in cislunar space and elsewhere. There's plenty of opportunity for people of a philosophical bent to join in on conversations. And I think that points to the genuine interdisciplinarity of this area. The perspective of artists and writers and really everyone, I think, is important to bring to bear, especially as we're contemplating, these grand endeavors where purportedly it's all of humanity that's supposed to benefit from this. So wouldn't it be nice if we heard from as much of humanity as possible?
Sure, absolutely. So could a space philosopher stop the launch of a rocket?
If they were really, really dedicated and willing to put their life at risk, possibly. I'm trying to think of anything aside from, breaking into a launch site and running up and calling up safety protocols that they would have to cancel the launch for. So I don't think any impact that, philosophy can have would be so direct as that, or at least the probability of that is quite low in my view. But I do think we can help contribute to having more productive conversations. So one thing that philosophers are really good at is pointing out hidden assumptions, identifying sort of principles of reasoning that are being implemented. When we're, offering those kinds of services, we can really improve decision making, provided that folks are willing to listen. So, can we press a button and stop an unwise space mission from taking place? Certainly not. However, do we have a role to play in improving conversations that maybe prevent us from getting to that point in the first place? Yeah, I'd like to think so.
You mentioned people might not or might listen to you. So who is it out there who listens to a space philosopher?
Well, a lot more people than you might think. Philosophers have reputations as being some of the most ivory tower of ivory tower academics. And to some extent, that's justified because philosophers often get concerned with, very abstract matters. But in the process of looking at this issues, and I started in philosophy, in philosophy of mathematics, which is, you know, one of the most pure areas that, that you could imagine. So, I mean, there's evidence that, that people are listening because people like me get invited on shows like this. And this is not a unique thing, in my career to be, you know, invited into venues where philosophers don't typically, show up. And so I think, there is a recognition. I won't say it's a recognition on the part of everyone in the space community, but it's a recognition, from a lot of, areas that we need to have a more comprehensive conversation about, spaceflight. We need to think more carefully about what we're doing. And maybe part of that is some hope that, you know, the philosophers will help us make better arguments so we can more easily do the things that we've always wanted to do. And I think, you know, there are people in the research community that, that are, you know, thinking about it from that angle. Someone that's familiar with my research would say that, you know, Schwartz really is in favor of space exploration, but that is restricted more towards scientific endeavors, and that he has, or rather I have, don't need to talk about myself in the third person here, that, you know, one can be in support of, you know, scientific endeavors, but oppose things like space mining or very hasty attempts to instigate space settlement. So that there is a nuanced position you can take, that to be a supporter of space exploration doesn't mean you have to support every last thing that folks like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos are advocating for.
Let's stay with those names. I mean, like, currently when we talk about space travel, of course, SpaceX comes to one's mind. Then as a next step, of course, perhaps the upcoming Artemis NASA mission as one of the next endeavors. So what do you think is going wrong in those fields that would require the involvement of a space philosopher?
So I think you know, there's an agenda setting that takes place. And of course, people like Musk and Bezos have, you know, very broad, visible platforms. And so people listen when they speak up. And a lot of sort of space fandom correlates with, you know, supporting the things that, that Musk and Bezos are talking about. And so what can a philosopher contribute to that? Well, you know, taking a closer look at the arguments that are being made. And what's interesting here is that the arguments that, that people are putting forward, whether it's Musk, Bezos, or really anyone else, haven't changed much since the dawn of the space age. We still talk about space in the same kinds of ways, at least here in the States, thinking about, you know, humans have some kind of destiny to explore the stars, that this will literally, you know, save humanity from extensive threats to our entire species. And most of those arguments, if they're any good, they require a lot more care and attention than are typically given to them. And in fact, many of those arguments, I think, tend to end up not working. They tend to have a very sort of poor evidential basis. And so I might be veering from the question, and I apologize if so.
No worries.
But a project that I've had in my own research, which I've sort of titled a series of papers, Myth-Free Space Advocacy, is taking a look at some of these arguments and trying to figure out, you know, where is the truth in them, if there is some truth at all? Because, you know, if we want to support space exploration, if we think it's important, shouldn't it be possible to demonstrate that importance using good reasoning rather than the same talking points that have been used for decades by people who don't necessarily have expertise in the areas that would, you know, reveal whether there's truth behind those assertions or not. So when people talk about space exploration being educationally inspiring, I'm much more willing to listen to that argument when it's being given by education scientists and psychologists. But astrophysicists and astronauts are not the kind of folks who by training have the expertise to really, you know, bring evidence to bear on that topic. When people talk about space as a frontier and how it will, you know, by opening up the space frontier, will sort of realize all of the same societal benefits that that the American westward expansion purported really realized. Well, when you look at what historians of the American West have to say about that, it stands in very great contrast to the rhetoric employed by NASA administrators and advocates like Bob Zubrin from the Mars Society. And that rhetoric permeates, at least in the States, the entire conversation about space exploration, and you can be kind of ostracized by the space supporting community if you don't, you know, close ranks with the sort of naked ideology that's being presented. And so I think, you know, philosophers are folks who are very well placed to challenge dogmatic thinking about space. And I see a lot of that when I look at the rhetoric surrounding space flight and space advocacy.
So what you're saying is, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, that what we are currently understanding as space travel and space exploration is at a very low level of intention. The low level of intention is to just go there because it's a new territory. We've been sort of discovering what's there to discover on Earth. So we're going to a new place, but with the same motivations and same intentions from back in the day that led into a bunch of issues. Am I taking you right here?
I think that's fair. Yeah. There's a few things to say here. And I think when we talk about, you know, evolution of thought, one thing we have to recognize is that space exploration is not a politically neutral endeavor. The sort of accepted position, the mainstream position on space exploration is a very political one, in that you see values that very much belong to sort of neoliberal conceptions of how society should be organized, a sort of preference for free market solutions, a desire to put up minimal regulatory roadblocks to space exploration initiatives. And that's not a value-free position to take. And there are other positions available. And I think it's an open question precisely to what extent the sort of the mainstream approach to space exploration will actually help to realize the promises that have been made of space exploration for a very long time. And I think that there's another irony there, which is that the people who are most committed to the idea that things like space mining and space settlement will solve all of our problems are also the ones most opposed to possible regulatory mechanisms that might actually enable space mining to benefit more people than just the wealthy few that own the mining corporations. How can you claim beyond pure faith in free market principles when there seems to be so much evidence that inequalities these days are increasing rather than decreasing? How can you claim that more of the same is going to result in improvements rather than exacerbating existing issues? So, I don't think we should be shy about looking at that underlying, ideology that's involved, because the lion's share of, popular books that come out about space are very much championing a traditional neoliberal perspective on this. And that tends to be part of the, if you don't agree with these, you're not really one of us, things that I see in the space advocacy community. There's a purity test. Are you a freedom person? And I don't think that's helpful. And so if we had a more tolerant environment to talk about space, if people like me, and I am being somewhat provocative in how I'm describing this, but if, one didn't have to sort of be identified as a heretic to take some of these, alternative views about, potential political or economic systems for space regulation, I think you're going to see healthier conversations.
How do we break that neoliberal logic and bring in that kind of thought that in the first place does not produce money? How can you adjust the system and tell the stock market, dear stock market, I'm bringing in a new term, and that is called ethics, and that is called moral, and it doesn't make money? How do you do that?
It's a tough problem, right? And I think, just trying to raise awareness that the realities of space exploration might be, in some cases, drastically different than what's being presented. And space mining is a great example of that to me, because when people talk about space resources, they talk about just the incredible quantities of resources that are available in our solar system and how, you know, the solar system could sustainably support quadrillions of humans if we're able to access all of the materials that are there. And, you know, we'll never have to worry about, you know, any kind of resource supply problems again in the future. And when you look at the resource totals, I mean, that sounds very compelling. It's just staggering the amount of raw material that's there. But that's not the only thing we need to be aware of. Supply chains, you know, don't immediately have access to, you know, the entire store of materials that are available, right? You have to set up an infrastructure, and at any given point, you're only going to be able to access a very small portion of that. And when you think about considerations that are relevant for space travel, well, directed energy propulsion could open up a lot of possibilities in the next few decades. But if that doesn't work out for any reason, we're sort of stuck with, you know, very, a need to be very, energy conservative in terms of, destinations. And so when you start factoring for, you know, fuel considerations, for energy considerations, for missions to near Earth asteroids as potential mining targets, a good comparison there would be with the amount of energy it takes to get to the moon and back, say. And so you're narrowing the pool of what we might call accessible asteroids for space mining if you've got to limit yourself to a certain outbound or inbound delta V on those missions. And the numbers and the total quantities start to get smaller and smaller as you start to think about some of these practical limitations on our ability to access space resources. And so when you look at what's realistically achievable over the next 50 to 100 years, the total that we can get at any given time in terms of, I don't know, water from near Earth asteroids or melted from the permanently shattered regions on the lunar surface is a very small number, all things considered. So if you're pitching space as this solution to all of our problems, and in particular as a solution to resource limitations, that's just a false promise. Absolutely.
Because it's a solution. It's a solution to nothing because the mindset, the growth mindset is still there.
Well, right. And the reality of, you know, what we'll be able to do on, you know, short time scales very much speaks against it. So if we've only got this tiny little chunk that we can get to right now, we can't just pretend as though we can do anything we want with it because we won't be able to. And what I really worry about, as someone who would like to see eventually humanity, you know, settle the solar system after we conduct some science, because I think if we go too fast, there'll be all kinds of interesting science that we just lose out on once humans start wrecking these environments. But, you know, when you think about water in particular, water is very important for lots of reasons. I mean, we need it to drink. If there are humans there, we can produce oxygen from it through electrolysis. A lot of people want to produce rocket fuel out of water that's mined from space. But if you've only got a tiny amount, and there was a paper that came out a couple of years ago that was making estimates about, you know, how much water could you get per month or per year through mining C-type asteroids from the near-Earth population of a certain size and delta-V sort of accessibility consideration. The numbers were actually surprisingly low, talking about something like 70 tons of water per month, which I forget the comparison, but at that rate, it would take on the order of like 3 years to fill up an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And, you know,
we're not there for the water. We're there for the, I don't know, whatever resource we want to see on Earth, right?
Well, that's another side of the question, too, is to what extent are we hoping to supply Earth with new resources versus use these resources in support of space expansion? And there are concerns on both sides because, you know, I can find very few resources in space that are not currently and for quite some time just going to be far more economical to source on Earth. Nickel is an issue long term. You know, platinum group elements long term are considerations, but and it does look like the potential sort of I'm just forgetting the technical term for this, but anyway, you know, it does look like asteroids are going to be a slightly better source in terms of, you know, quantities, parts per million, parts per billion of platinum elements than terrestrial sources. But still, I mean, it's a much tougher thing to do. We don't have the technology yet. And at any given time, we're only going to be able to get a very small addition to what we already have. We're never just going to have all of the resources of the near Earth asteroids even at our disposal. So we're never going to have this glut of new resources, whether they're for terrestrial consumption or for space-based initiatives. And so if we don't think very carefully about how we manage that, and this is a consideration that regardless of your political ideology, you ought to share. If you're concerned about, you know, expanding our spaceflight capabilities, if you want to actually do the bootstrapping that everyone talks about, you know, using what you find there to create the ability to go further, to access more resources, you can't be stupid with the first stuff you get. Because if you use up, if you waste entirely your early spoils, suppose, you know, we mine out all of the near-Earth asteroids that we can get to in the next 10 years at like a return delta V of 3 or 4 kilometers a second. And it's not a lot of water we're talking about mm-hmm. there. So, you know, it's not inconceivable that could happen. If those resources are not put to some kind of productive use, whatever you think of a productive use of that is, you know, that could be your ceiling for what you can do without having to come back and rely on, you know, terrestrial supply. So sure. If you're concerned, you know, if getting to Mars and the main belt asteroids and the Galilean moons is something, you know, you want to do in the future, and you think that exploiting the resources of the near-Earth asteroids and the moon is an important step in that, you have to agree with me that we need to think carefully about how we manage this, that we can't just say, leave it to the market. Because if you leave it to the market, there's no guarantee that it's actually going to do the things that you'd like to see happen. You know, in some sense, space has been left to the market since its existence, and the market hasn't delivered space colonies. So, you know, I wonder, why is there so much faith in this particular ideology here?
If you had been around in the 60s, would you have greenlit the Apollo missions?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, odds are I'd probably be somebody standing to the side and saying that the sort of, you know, geopolitical rationale, the primary objective being to, you know, win this prestige battle against the USSR, wouldn't strike me as a very compelling reason for supporting such an endeavor. And of course, you know, it wasn't until, what is it, Apollo 17, that there was actually a professional scientist that was sent up there. I'd probably say that that's a big missed opportunity. I can certainly understand how something more scientifically oriented probably would have been infeasible. And that might turn this into a question about, well, you know, if it didn't get started that way, would it have got started at all? You know, would we have anything resembling the current, you know, space exploration regime that we have? And how would that compare? I'm sensitive to especially a lot of the social criticisms that were made. And one thing that really struck me recently with the SpaceX first launch with crew back in, was it late May? Happening at the same time as, you know, some of these massive protests after the death of George Floyd. And I couldn't help but think of the Whitey on the Moon poem and Scott Heron's, you know, lovely poem about the Apollo era, really, and how there was this huge disconnect, both in terms of what's happening from a racial perspective in the United States, but also what's happening on the sort of, you know, legislative and government end, this contrast between what the government's doing and what many of the people perceive as the needs. And that moment seemed especially salient, you know, this year here in the States. And to dismiss those concerns, to think that they're of no moment, I think is a mistake.
They say that exploration has always been a motor for human evolution, societal evolution. So what do you make of that? Because, I mean, like, if you start reflecting on future space missions on that level with the criteria you're bringing to the table, you're sort of potentially slowing down the evolution of those fields. So would you also consider it possible that you're slowing down human evolution? And is that something positive or is it something negative?
So I don't see evolution as something that with any kind of direct moral standing. You know, I think it's just a change in adaptation to new circumstances. And if you think that sort of some notion of fitness is morally salient, and, you know, there are many ethicists that take a sort of evolutionary approach to it. And a couple people in the sort of space ethics community adopt a position kind of like that, Kelly Smith being probably the most prominent example. So I would maybe challenge that we ought to think of evolution as some inherently, you know, ethically oriented process. But nevertheless, I think there are open questions about the extent to which we have exploratory urges and the extent to which those have contributed both to past migrations as well as possible future migrations into space. There's sort of some genetic and anthropological research that's been done about things like novelty seeking and is there some kind of, you know, gene or complex of genes that are associated with that. And the story that's kind of come out of that so far seems to be that the genes that are associated with novelty seeking and exploratory behavior, and their exploratory behavior means something more like, you know, just reconnoitering in your local environment to be aware of resources. So, you know, kind of, you know, checking your fridge 5 minutes after you checked it is exploration in this kind of sense. Your brain's rewarding you for being aware of food resources, right? And the story seems to be that these behavioral traits, if they were, if there is this basis here, it seems like they were selected for after periods of migration. So once people were, you know, because of food shortages or conflict, kind of forced to seek elsewhere to live, you know, those that were a bit more willing to walk around and see where the streams were, where the hunting would be good, and so forth, were the ones that were more likely to, you know, pass on their traits to the next generation. And so, you know, do we have some innate biological urge to go out and explore space, to settle and live there? I don't think there's good evidence to suggest that. But if we do those things, we are placing, you know, people in an incredibly unique, new, very hostile environment. And it seems like it's very much to be expected that there would eventually be some kind of, you know, evolution. Is it evolution to an entirely new species? You know, maybe over a very long period of time. But nonetheless, over a few generations, maybe you start to see some, you know, different personality types emerge compared to the terrestrial situation. If you think that, you know, that kind of flowering of human diversity is something worth producing, then I can see an argument for space expansion, space settlement there. And of course, there are lots of people that want to say, well, you know, it doesn't seem like we're well adapted to Mars or anywhere else. So maybe we can use technology to, you know, remake ourselves so that, you know, we don't need these huge expensive space habitats to live on Mars. Maybe we can, you know, harden ourselves to radiation, figure out ways to subsist on very low oxygen levels through some kind of genetic engineering or cyborgization or something of this nature. You know, and so a lot of folks will have, you know, that on their agenda, in part because, you know, they're so passionate about wanting to go out into space. And, you know, by any means necessary seems to be a credo for some.
Considering the current interest in all things that go together with the discovery and rediscovery of space, it's very hard these days not to think of some sort of escapism, that we are sort of running away from ourselves. And this is why we're producing momentum upward or wherever you go when you want to go to space. Does that make sense to you?
Not at all. I understand why people are seduced by the idea, but I think it's hard to maintain that sort of level of desire when you start to acknowledge some of the, you know, incredibly harsh conditions you're going to have to put yourself into. You know, Mars is maybe the most attractive place for humans to live outside of Earth, but, you know, Mars is much more difficult, is a much more difficult place to live in than Earth would be even after, you know, global warming ravages this planet, whenever that happens. Hopefully it doesn't, but, you know, skeptical that we'll get our act together in time. So, I don't think, you can escape, anywhere into space that's going to be a better place, an easier place to live than Earth will be, even given all of the issues that we have.
There's no fair point to it. That's what you think.
Well, I think there's something to be said for it. It's just not going to be what most people want the rationale to be. And this is in part just a reflection on my own sort of path through being a lifelong lover and supporter of space exploration, right? So, you know, for as long as I can remember, I've been interested in space, been a huge fan of science fiction. You know, for a long time growing up, I wanted to be an astrophysicist or an astronaut, went to space camp, and things of that nature. And one of the things I've sort of recognized recently is that I think most of my appreciation for space, when it comes down to it, is sort of aesthetic. I'm just fascinated by the imagery and have a great desire to experience, not necessarily through the lens of a telescope, but to actually maybe be in a place where I can look out on an alien landscape. And, I don't know how important that consideration is. I don't know what kind of value I can place on it. I think it's probably something that almost every space advocate shares to some degree. This just, you know, desire to experience what the space environment, what the solar system, what the universe has to offer. But, you know, does that get me to all of the things that, you know, ordinary space advocates are going to push for? Here's an argument that it doesn't, which is that, you know, if ultimately why we love space so much is that we find it so, you know, aesthetically engaging, that we find space so beautiful, shouldn't that mean we should care more about preserving its beauty rather than trying to remake it into something that is going to serve, you know, some more short-term or trivial purpose for us?
Isn't that what makes us human, to set our foot on wherever we go and leave our trash wherever we go?
Well, I mean, if we're thinking about this based on how we've acted historically, sure. But if we think about what it is that ought to demonstrate our humanity, you know, what kind of people we aspire to be rather than, you know, we've unavoidably been in the past. And, you know, people talk about space as this place to experience better ways of living, as this place where utopia is within reach. And, you know, that is, you know, an unrealistic hope to have, but
I mean, it's not a new idea.
Right. And what I come back to there is, you know, why are we so willing to believe in that possibility and yet so unwilling to try out different ways of realizing it? Why are we so committed to one particular way of trying to, you know, create a human future in space?
Let's make a quick thought experiment. So let's travel back to the days of Plato. And Plato played around with a bunch of great ideas, and one was particularly interesting when he designed the philosopher's state. So let's imagine you are part of this philosopher's state, and you are responsible for space missions in Plato's philosopher's state. So you're the space guy. So how would you set up the ideal Platonic philosopher states space mission?
Oh,
Jim Schwartz.
Yeah. Well,
you're in charge.
Well, to respond to the shape of that thought experiment in the first place, I think most of us in philosophy don't agree with Plato about the philosopher kings being the ones that ought to rule. But nevertheless, suppose I am, whether against my will or not, put in such a position and unable to, you know, defer. I think the first thing I'd do is I'd try to listen to as many people as I can and not predetermine what is or is not important in terms of what missions ought to be supported, how quickly to engage in settlement and mining and other kinds of endeavors. And I think I'd try to strive a greater balance of interests than we've really seen, or at least that we've seen recently. I haven't been around that long, so I can't speak to personal experience for space policy discussions for that many decades into the past. But I see a very lopsided conversation right now, one where the commercial end is sort of determining everything, getting everything that it wants, and the scientists have to deal with, you know, the astronomers have a much more polluted sky to observe. If people have their way on Mars, then, you know, any possibility of confirming endemic Martian life might go by the wayside. But, you know, Mars is not the only place where science is at stake. Really, anytime you're in an environment, you're disrupting it, you're impeding some kind of possible scientific investigation. And so what I'd like to see is a greater voice, not only from the scientific community, but from other areas of humanity. There's a project I'm working on right now. I don't know how much I can say about it, considering it's not yet under contract anywhere, but it's an anthology project about trying to give a voice to stakeholders, to individuals who are not members of the sort of space exploration orthodoxy, lots and lots of different cultural backgrounds, trying to get representation of women's perspectives. Actually my main interest in this project in the first place is to get perspective. Because most of the publications on space exploration and most of the conversation, and again, I'll hedge with in the States, comes from a very narrow, very limited perspective. You know, for the most part,
technological perspective, that is.
Yeah. And so for the most part, the only people that write books about space are the ones that, you know, think it's the best thing ever and, you know, will hardly tolerate views to the contrary. But if we want a really good appreciation of what's important about space, what are the best things to be doing in space, we need to listen to as many different kinds of people as we can.
Would you consider Carl Sagan as one of the last important space philosophers?
I would go back and forth about whether I want to call him a philosopher. It's sort of a professional term for my neck of the woods. Although, you know, in the public mind, it just means someone who's a bit more reflective or contemplative. And I think he still stands out as someone who was, you know, sort of much more well-read outside the natural sciences than a lot of other folks that have kind of taken on his mantle. And that, you know, he was much more willing to engage with philosophy, right? There's a lot of at least ancient Greek philosophy that'll show up in some of his writings. And he wasn't as much of a sort of snake oil salesman as others have ended up being. What I found really interesting when I was working on a planetary protection paper a number of years ago is sometime in the mid-90s, NASA put on this, you know, what is the value of space exploration conference, and Sagan was one of the invited speakers there. And there's this beautiful quote. I'm not going to be able to find it, so it'll just be from memory. But somehow or other, a sort of issue of the moon comes up. And Sagan is kind of reacting to what maybe he's hearing from poets at the time who are chiding, you know, now that we've been to the moon and we've sort of discovered there's nothing there, quote unquote. And now that we sort of know a bit more about what the moon is, how it came to be, it's much more difficult to project, our own thoughts and beliefs onto it. And this reminds me of something that George R. R. Martin had said about, you know, how Mars exploration has kind of killed Mars science fiction, because now we have to sort of confront the reality of Mars and if there aren't, you know, burgeoning civilizations there, it's less credible to write stories in that way. And I think Sagan's got a beautiful reply to that, which is that, well, you know, you can find beauty there if you're looking to find it. That's not an exact quote, but that, you know, there's poetry there if you have the wherewithal to discover it. And the same should apply to Mars, that, you know, even if the Mars we found isn't the Mars we wanted all along, that doesn't mean there's no reason to be incredibly interested and passionate about what's there. And there's a planetary scientist, Sean McMahon, that wrote a beautiful paper about Mars aesthetics and describing Mars as, you know, a sort of person with training in astrobiology and geology sees it. And some of the things he had to say were quite moving to me in terms of, you know, here's this new lens that I can wear to see things in this environment that I wasn't able to see before then. And so Sagan, to me, stands out as someone who is certainly more open and encouraging of broader consideration of space than people that see it as primarily a sort of purely technological endeavor.
Have we lost our balance between head and heart? Are you missing the heart side of things at the moment?
I would want to say no. I would want to say that it's not one versus the other. It's that it's a contributory endeavor that, you know, the heart cares, the head reasons. And I think a lot of people that are passionate about space are passionate about it out of some kind of care or concern for humanity. And that's a very laudable thing. But it's also something that doesn't determine what ought to happen. We can care about the human species. We can care about ensuring its continuance. But that doesn't automatically imply that we need to have a settlement on the moon and Mars in the next 5 years. Otherwise, we're not demonstrating our concern for humanity. There are interesting arguments out there that suggest that, you know, having space settlements could destabilize things in a geopolitical sense and make things less secure. So I don't think we can immediately infer that being concerned for humanity implies, you know, this particular spaceflight activity and nothing else. But there are also other things to care about. The heart should be directing us toward other places. Concern for maybe the space environment itself. There might be something to be said there. Concern for possible life that we might find. Concern for not just the continued existence of the human species, but the continued existence of the human species living well, concern for the lives of people that are living in space and not just whether people are living in space. And to draw on why these things are connected and why they're connected in very important ways is that, you know, what we learn, what we discover, you know, what the head directs us to tells us about what there is. And of course, what we value is always dependent on what we know. And what we value directs us in our future endeavors in terms of what we decide is worth doing, what we decide is worth studying. So there's this, you know, incredible mutualism between these things. And I think, you know, I'd like to see a greater melding of these as we think about space, that we need to think not just about what it's possible for us to do, but what we care about.
I have a personal question, Jim, if I may. I assume your smartphone is right next to you. So just imagine the smartphone is ringing right now and you got a call from an unknown number and you're picking up the call and it's from the Enterprise that's hovering way up there above you. And they ask you, hey, do you want to come along? We can beam you up, or you want to stay? What would you do?
And we're imagining that I don't doubt that this offer is sincere. Is that? that's tough for me. Well, the transporter, I worry, kills me and just makes a copy. So let's set that concern aside too, right? Yeah.
I would make a beautiful next episode when we talk about the twin paradox and yeah. Stuff like that.
But anyway, you know, I'd want to say I'd probably go. I'd want to know more about, you know, would I be coming back? How onerous would the trip be? You know, I don't think I would be getting on any spacecraft that currently exist. But you know,
would you want to come back? Would you want to go back?
I think, I wouldn't want to leave without knowing it's a possibility. Because maybe I get up there and I discover that my hopes and expectations weren't correct. I'm not saying I have evidence to suggest that I would have a change in mind like that. But, you know, there's a lot of things you'd be leaving behind. And if I wouldn't have to leave those things behind, if I could go more, if I could be a tourist rather than going to stay. And, you know, relationships matter. Can I take my friends with me? Would my friends want to come? You know, what kind of human community would I now be joining? And it would.
You could bring one friend, and your dog.
Well, how about three cats? Can I take three cats? So to me, I guess what it comes down to is, for me, it's not merely a decision about getting to experience space, but getting to be a part of a community. And if that's a sort of exclusive choice, if I have to have a sort of an isolated, solitary experience of space, or I have to remain on Earth, I'll probably remain on Earth.
Wonderful.
But if there is some kind of, you know, shared community, that I'm a member of, that, you know, thinks about space, that has a similar passion, that provides the ability to form meaningful relationships, then, you know, my odds of saying no decrease dramatically. And that point, I think, is very important as we think about space settlement and, you know, what kind of communities we are planning or not planning for as we entertain ideas about lunar and Martian settlement. And, you know, we need very much to not forget that these are going to be human beings that still have human needs.
Wonderful. Jim, we're almost at the end of our show. We do have a fun tradition at the end of our show, and that is that you, without much thinking, are welcome to share or invited to share a story about space or science or philosophy that comes up to your mind without much thinking. We call it a space cafe espresso. So you're free to share anything you would like to share with our audience, with me, that fascinates you about whatever you might want to share with us. Science, philosophy, space. Ready for that?
Oh, I think I got something. It might be a little out of left field, but anyway. So as I'm sure many of you listening are similar to me in is that, you know, we're lovers of science fiction. And of course, our love of space is mediated by our engagement with science fiction. And one of the more, I think, important science fiction series in recent times is The Expanse. And of course, the television production of it, you know, brings it to a much wider audience than might get from just reading the books. But one of the things I love the most about The Expanse is it's really attempting to be honest about what living in space will be like. And it's very much attempting to be honest about people's motivations for doing the things they do in space. And I think one of the more fascinating individual stories in that is Gunnery Sergeant Bobby Draper. And of course, she's a Marine for the Martian Congressional Republic's Navy. And the Mars of The Expanse is very much the Mars that places like the National Space Society and the Mars Society envision, where, you know, it's founded by these pioneers. They're trying to remake the world. And, you know, we only want productive citizens. And, you know, we don't want much to do with these sort of takers back on Earth who you know, are in this stagnating society. And what we see in her story is this sort of increasing realization of not just what she believes, but the origin of her beliefs and the greater context in which, you know, she resides as well as her planet of origin sits in. And, you know, thinking as a philosopher, you know, I think what she's seen is, you know, she's having some kind of paradigm shift. Her worldview is shifting because now she has to, you know, depend for her life on strangers, on people from different planets, from different cultures. And she ultimately realizes that she can't, you know, continue to support the government of her society because it's pursuing policies that are very antithetical to the ideals that she has actually had all along. And what I think is so beautiful about that story arc is it shows a person that progresses as a human that finds redemption because she remains open to evidence, because she remains open to the possibility that she's got things wrong. And that, moreover, she's been lucky enough to find herself in a very close-knit community of people that care about the same things. And I think that's a great lesson for everyone that thinks about space, which is that a lot of things get said about space exploration, but the context often, determines whether those things are trustworthy or reliable or not. And that, you know, let's not always take things on faith. Let's not just immediately believe the promises that are made by space advocates. Let's be open to the possibility that, you know, there's evidence that could come up that could cause us to shift our views. And there's nothing wrong with that. If they cause us to change our values, there's nothing wrong with that, as long as it's something we take on ourselves and that we are not forced into.
Thank you so much, Jim Schwartz, for taking the time and for being on the show. That was really, really fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun on this end as well.
What a ride. I hope you can share my feelings. I mean, such conversations are so incredibly refreshing and important in our little bubble worlds. Thoughts that challenge, put us to the test, and put things in a new light. Wonderful. By the way, check out the show notes on Spacewatch Global. I'm posting a screenshot of our conversation here, not least because I'm super proud of my brand new Spacewatcher t-shirt. You can get it in our merchandise section from now on. Thanks for being here today, and thanks for your messages. For those who don't know yet, you can reach us, as usual, at podcast@spacewatch.global. Thanks for riding with us.